Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every other week two nerds get together to rate, read, and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Jordy Bailey.
And I'm the hero that the universe just wants to make a villain, Duncan Nichol.
Duncan, this episode's a teeny weeny bit late, which is entirely my fault. So I apologize to you and to the listeners.
Apology accepted. I'll take my destiny point.
Yeah, as long as you're keeping track of them. You told me like a year ago you were keeping track. That's still the case, right?
That is still the case. I think you spend them, I don't. So I'm basically saving up until the day I want to just force you through the entirety of Wheel of Time.
I'm ready for it, Duncan. I'm steeling myself. I may regret those words, but I feel like it's going to be interesting. I'm spending my destiny points. I spent a couple of these. I think to make you read, the last one was I made you read Children of, not Anguish and Anarchy, Virtue and Vengeance, Violence? The second Children of Blood and Bone book. And last time I forced you to finally, because you were trying to make me read Uprooted by Naomi Novik instead of the sequel to Naomi Novik's Deadly Education, a book we read 2 years ago. We both enjoyed a lot. We're excited to see where it went. But you decided to read something else for next week. And I've been waiting 2 years for you to pick Doing the Last Graduate, which I was very excited to read. And as a matter of principle, I never forced your hand until you tried to make me read a different book by Naomi Novik. And I could only handle so much.
You finally broke. And just for those wondering more on about, destiny points are a little format style where if any one of us messes up or delays the episode coming to you guys, then the other one gets to force a certain book to be reviewed, no matter what the other person may say or think.
Yeah, normally the way the podcast works is we can only choose to start a series. We can't make someone read a whole series because that's not what the show is about. We want variety. We want to read books that we're both excited about. Unless, of course, we spend a destiny token.
Which is a really funny thing to say because I was excited to read the sequel. I don't know why I haven't been picking it. I think it just, I'm not going to lie, Jordy, I was just being a bit belligerent. It just got to the point where it became a running joke not picking this book. And that's just what kept it going because I just cover the bases. I love Deadly Education. I thought it was a cracking first book to experience by Naomi Novik. I thought the premise was great, the characters I was engaged with. It took something that we've seen quite a lot, which is kids in a special school and sort of high school drama, but it took such a cool edge to it. It made this environment where these kids are at magic school, but it is horrific, it is deadly, and it makes the fear of being like a social outcast a genuine fear for your life. And we'll go a bit more into why that's the case as we talk about its sequel. But Jordy, before we get there, have you been reading, watching, experiencing any other kind of fantasy or non-fantasy stuff that you want to share with us?
I've been reading a lot. Our episode was delayed by a week because I goofed and I messed up our last recording schedule. So I've been reading a lot in the meantime. I went on my hiking holiday. I was hiking the South Downs Way, which is the whole walk is 100 miles. I only did 75 miles of it.
Lightweight.
I had a really good time. I love hiking and camping and that. It also gives me a lot of time to listen to audiobooks. It wasn't really my most productive time. I actually started and couldn't bring myself to finish a bunch of books because I just found them a bit challenging. Like I bounced off another of the culture books. God, which was one called? It's called, this is Accession, which I think is book number 4. Couldn't finish that. I reread a couple of books on the way. I reread Red Storm Rising by Tom Clancy, which is a hell of a book to reread. It's very long. But I did finally finish Foundation's Edge, which I was reading last time. Really enjoyed that. Definitely the best Foundation book so far. Actually, like, exciting drama, not just, like, big, important sci-fi ideas. Actually, like, oh yeah, this is just an exciting book. Wow.
That is really interesting to hear. I've had Foundation's Edge sort of sitting on the back shelf for quite a while. I'll be honest, Jordy, one of the things that sort of intimidated me is that not that it's a long book, but it is maybe twice as long as the previous Foundation book. And knowing Asimov's style, I sort of went, oh, can I take a longer book of his more sort of clinical, dry exploration of these kind of scientific ideas?
No, it feels like a much shorter book than Foundation and Empire, because it's much more like an actual book. It feels like a continuous narrative that follows one idea and one string of characters, as opposed to jumping around the decades. And it's just a good book. It's full of drama and excitement and like, oh my god, how are they going to get out of this one?
That makes me so happy to hear that you've given me a lot more confidence now to finally kind of take the plunge and crack through Foundation, because I think even more than you, I love the original Foundation trilogy. I think they're just amazing. And I've gone back and I've read The Robot, The Complete Robot, and Caves of Steel, and Naked Sun, I think the last one was called. All brilliant. Big thumbs up for Asimov.
So that was all I was doing. I was a little bit of a sci-fi kick with Accession and Foundation's Edge. Had a good time. I started to read a little bit more of The Once and Future King, but that's an extraordinarily long book, so I didn't finish that. But yeah, lots of reading, lots of progress getting done, doing some more revisits on my novel, and I think that's all gone pretty well. How about you, Dunk? What have you been up to in the meantime?
Oh, talking about a sci-fi kick. No, wait, no. Before I talk about my sci-fi kick, The Wheel of Time Season 3, this is the first episode we've recorded since that came to an end. I've got to say, Geordie, and everyone's listening, I can't recommend The Wheel of Time enough as a TV show. It has come on leaps and bounds from the first season, and I never want to be that person who's like, oh, just push your way through the first season. It gets better. I want to say that the first season, it should still be good enough for you. If you're watching the first season like, I'm actively not enjoying this, then fair enough, maybe it's not worth it. But if you watch the first season and you go, well, that was all right, it gets so much better as it goes on in terms of the pacing, the story arcs, the way it balances multiple narratives going on. But most impressive of all, as someone who's read the first five books in Wheel of Time, I haven't finished the whole series. I did DNF in the middle of the fifth book because I was just like, this is too much for me. There's variety out there. I want to sample it. The TV show does an amazing job of truncating and bringing together plot threads in a way that I feel you don't lose the core characters. Their arcs still play out just as they need to, and the world still seems rich and vibrant. But you just get places a hell of a lot quicker.
How do you feel it works as a supplement to the books, as opposed to, I say supplement, what I meant was, how do you think it works as something, as an alternative to the books? Do you think you're getting the full, complete picture?
You're getting... No, I won't say full and complete. You're definitely not getting the full and complete, but you're certainly getting what matters most to our core cast of characters. Just a quick example, because I feel like I need to explain myself. In the books, there's a bit where like two of the characters get separated from the group and they go on like a journey on their own across the land. And I kid you not, mate, in the first Wheel of Time book, you genuinely see something play out like three times in a row. They go to an inn, they struggle to pay. They come up with a way to pay. They stay the night. Some bad guy tries to get at them. And this happens like three times in slightly different ways back to back. TV show, guess what? It happens once. Because it only needs to happen once.
Yeah.
Wheel of Time, or even all the fans would agree, is a bloated series. It being cut down is not a knock. It is a very, I think, legitimate improvement. Obviously, some people like the bloatedness because they like to sit in the world for hours on end. Totally understand, it is a vibe. But I don't need to know about the architecture of every city. In the TV show, though, but that's great. Because instead of being described the architecture, I can just see it. I don't need to be described someone's dress. You can just see it. Perfect. Move along.
So Wheel of Time is a big one. Anything else?
Mate, sci-fi. Talk about continuing a sci-fi series. I've started reading Babylon's Ashes in our extra week we had.
Ooh!
So this is the sixth book in the Expanse series. I've been slowly working my way through the series for a number of years now. Genuinely, it's one of the only things, Geordie, not to, I hope this doesn't cost as an insult, it's one of the only seats I generally think, if I didn't have that podcast to do, I'd smash through this a hell of a lot quicker. I do often look for breaks in our schedule, or when we're doing a lighter book, and I go, excellent, I can squeeze in an expanse. Babylon's Ashes, I haven't finished it, so I don't want to give my full thoughts. It's certainly, in the series, the one that seems most closely linked to the previous book. The first four books, I think, did a great job of, while pushing the overall narrative forward, having quite self-contained story arcs, with a clear setup, villain of the piece, resolution, and then normally having a little time skip after that, whereas Babylon Ashes very much continues neatly on from the fifth book. It's a pro and cons. I think it's a lot of, in some respects, you're like, why am I still on this villain? I'm used to this turning over a bit faster. But at the same time, because we've had the setup from book five, we're right into the action all the quicker.
Absolutely. I remember getting the end of, what's the one before it? Nemesis Games. Which actually, I think that sounds like, it definitely sounds like a Tom Clancy novel. I got to the end of Nemesis Games and I was like, man, that was a really exciting scene. I can't wait to see what happens next. And then the book was over and I was like, I genuinely felt like someone had jerked my chain and I couldn't believe it was done because I was so excited and wrapped up in the action. And thank God I was not reading it as it came out, because that would have been vicious to have to wait after that.
Nemesis Games ends on a very much like an Avengers Assembled scene. All the characters have been separated throughout the book, finally gathered together, and they're like, right, now we've been hit, but now we've got to punch back. And then it like cuts the credits, and you're like, oh. So I'm really happy this book doesn't waste your time as a reader, like resetting the pieces or even ramping up again. It very feels up much like it keeps the tempo going from that climax, which is great.
Mm.
Other thing I need to quickly talk about, I have continued to read Dynamite comics, Barsoon, Princess of Mars, comic book adaptions. These are based on the Edgar Burroughs science fantasy series, I'm going to call it. Very much a early exploration of just sci-fi in general. And I call it fantasy because some of the elements are out there. But Dynamite Comics did a comic adaptation of the books, and once they ran out of book material, they continued to expand on it by doing kind of spin-offs with other characters. I spoke about this a little bit on the last episode. I'm just going to say, Geordie, having continued to read more of their content, oh my goodness, the pendulum of quality is insane between sub-series. It's a little bit mind-blowing. And also, it gets to the point where they start doing crossovers. So I'm reading Warlords of Mars, and Warlords of Mars has crossovers with, I kid you not, other Burroughs character. There's a Tarzan crossover where Tarzan gets sent to Mars,
when Tarzan goes to Mars,
and there's also a Gulliver's Travels crossover, which I wasn't expecting.
That I was not expecting that either. That feels very odd.
It was. And I'm like, did you just have the license? Is this character in the public domain? How have you... Why did you... Very interesting approach. I would say, if you're interested, the original series called Warlords of Mars is very good in the sense it adapts the works, I think, quite well. And then once you're over that, guys, it's the Wild West. Just take your pick. If you're enjoying it, go for it. If not, definitely stop. I've got it on Kindle Unlimited, so that's kind of why I keep plugging through it, just because it's costing me nothing to pick each one of these sub-series up and go, what are you? What creative decision is this? So, yeah, if you want something a bit more out there, maybe give that a go. But, Geordie, The Last Graduate, Naomi Novik, second book in the Scholarman series. If you haven't listened to our previous episode on Digital Education, I highly recommend you go back and give that a listen. It will probably be worth your time. Maybe add a bit more context to this episode as well.
Right, Duncan, when I first began reading this book, I was like, it's been a really long gap. I hope I remember everything. And I think I remembered the most important stuff. But I do think that my inability to remember some of this did cloud my enjoyment a tiny amount. I didn't remember all the side characters, nor the significance of their relationship or the nuances of their relationship to the main character, Elle. I also, like, as those who've listened to the previous episode will know, I said Elle's currently in her second year of four. How can she be the last graduate? Well, that was wrong. She was in her third year in the first book, and now she's in her fourth and final year, so shows what I remember.
I had a very similar experience. But again, though, I remembered everything that mattered, and I remembered the core characters that mattered. And I certainly felt that wherever I kind of came across a character interaction or a bias that Elle was expressing towards another character, the book did a fairly good job to kind of give me sufficient context to then go, okay, I know who this guy is. The only kind of thing that I felt a little bit weak on is who exactly were the characters involved in the climax of the previous book? Because there was a very like tight-knit group that went on like a heroic mission at the end of the last book. And I was in this one like, oh, were you part of that? Were you in the, like, the in crowd? And when a book that's so predominantly about who's in the in and who's on the out, when it comes to like social dynamics, like, that does hurt it a little bit. But I certainly felt like Naomi Novik did a good enough job that by sort of the third way mark, everything had sort of come back to me and I knew what I needed to know.
Duncan, to cut to the quick of it, did you like this book?
Jordy, I love this book. This is great fun.
Oh, excellent.
Genuinely, I don't know what to say in terms of compared to the first book. There has been that little bit of time. I would probably just say I enjoyed it just as much. It was on very much an even plane. In my mind, it had the same sort of interesting ideas, the same good character relationships, but it did push the overall narrative forward, and it succeeded in not just feeling like too much of a retread. The first book has a very deliberate...
I definitely agree with that.
Time spent where Elle's an outcast, and she slowly has to work her way up, and there's a big mission at the end with a big final fight. Whereas this book, Elle starts off with the friends she had from the last one. You know, she has progressed, and we keep pushing that forward. It's just that kind of the goalpost for success for our main character get moved and moved and moved throughout this book. So
yes,
she keeps growing, but at the same time, what she's trying to pull off gets harder and harder and harder.
Yeah. The stuff, I think, which worked in the first book continue to work in the second one. The places where it departs and the book changes quite a lot, that's the riskiest stuff. So the first book, if my memory serves me correctly, was over like a couple of months. It was like most of the way through the third year, we're getting catched up with Elle and all her previous time at the Scholomance, at the interdimensional wizard school where children get eaten by monsters. And we get caught up with her previous experience at the school. We get introduced to her fellow students. She makes friends. She starts to develop a budding will-they-won't-they relationship. And then she has to fight a bunch of monsters at the end. And in this book, there's a humongous change, which is that it takes place over the course of an entire year. So in order to get Elle, this is one of my big questions I had. Like, how is the next book going to be different? It's called The Last Graduate. She's going to graduate. How is it going to be different, stretched over this much longer period of time? You know, it's not going to be as moment-to-moment focused in the way the previous book was. It isn't going to be about sudden, exciting changes. It's going to be about the gradual development of just going through the school year, more similar to other wizard boarding school books.
I see the comparison to be made. I don't think this really has that much blood with Harry Potter, even less so in this first, in the second book.
No, I agree. I mean, there's more talk about exams. They do have exams. They have to revise for exams. And that's true of like the later Harry Potter books, like, you know, the fifth and sixth one.
I think one of the main things that kind of separates this out is this kind of book where the early Harry Potter books particularly have that kind of like mystery aspect, and you know, they always sneak out under the invisibility cloak and they're trying to solve the riddle or what's going on, we can't talk to the adults. What really puts the front and center in this book and the whole dynamic to do a Hogwarts comparison is about them trying to reach out to other students. It's as if Harry Potter, to use that as a framework, it's as if one of the Harry Potter books was about making common ground with Slytherin instead of Harry just going, they're the evil wizards in that house.
Yeah. The first book, we talked about how it was a slightly, headstrong analogy? Am I saying it right? Allegory, not analogy. It was a headstrong allegory for capitalism. The way magic is set up in the world is strongly laid out to resemble wealth. People have wealth of magic. Magic is generated through effort and hard work. So you can do push-ups to generate magic. You can knit to generate magic. The more strain it takes, the more you generate. But there are rich kids at the school, and they have a great stores of magic left over to them before they even arrived. So they have a completely unfair advantage at going through the wizard school and surviving all the monster attacks. The first book was all about one weirdo from the rich kids who was helping out the poor kids, and the way in which this sort of upset the balance of a school, and the way people turned against him and Elle for upending the system. The second book is about going from personal defiance of a system to overhauling the system completely.
I think that's a very apt kind of conclusion. And firstly, I really like that. I think we've talked about this before, and I cannot remember when, how often a book, the heroes are all about protecting the status quo. And I love it when it's about upturning it. It really drives me mad, particularly when you get narratives. I'm trying to think of a good example. I'm going to say maybe the Falcon and the Winter Soldier, that Marvel TV show, maybe had a bit of this.
I haven't seen it.
Okay. Well, in that, you had this, the enemy group. They're a terrorist organization. They're attacking people because they're called like the flag burners or something. But the ideology is that the world was better during the snap because humanity actually came together as one group. And so they're fighting against the system because they don't like the fact that we've all split up into our nations again. And they're obviously the villains. They're painted as the villains. They are terrorists. They're committing acts of terror. But they're fighting against what they believe to be like a corrupt system. You know, the status quo is not the right thing. And obviously the heroes is supposed to stop to that, but I really much prefer if the heroes could just take a moment to go, yeah, but what is the pro? Why is our system like this? Why is it not more important to actually promote more bilateral agreement and work? Like, there's such a more interesting conversation to be had.
And even when you have stories which are about rebels, they tend to be fighting against overwhelming evil dystopian systems. So, like, my girlfriend has been rereading the Hunger Games books because a new Hunger Games book has come out. It's by Haymitch. It's called Something on the Reaping. I should know what it's called. She's mentioned it 100 times. And in that, when in the original Hunger Games books, you know, Katniss fights against the Capitol. And the Capitol is this gigantic, it's American evil blown up to 11. You've got like a parody of reality television. You've got a fascist government in control. You've got people divided up in lines. But again, it's blown up to 11, such of a point that you can have this critique against this system that's ultimately kind of toothless, because it doesn't actually line up that well with the ills of society. You know, when it's so panderized, it's so blown up, it loses its focus. I feel like this book is much, because it exists in this comfortable allegory, and, you know, it's obviously fantastical. We're talking about magic instead of money, but the lines are clear, and it's the parallel thought, it's consistent, and the evil is banal. There's no mustache twirling villainy going on here. The rich kids feel comfortable, and they don't want their system to be challenged. And there was this bit right towards the end of the book where one of the rich kids goes against the plan which is very egalitarian, and says, well, we're not actually going to do this right. You know, like, we're just going to keep the system as it is. We've just humored this idea so far because we needed to work together to get past this, but we're not actually going to overthrow the system. And I was initially quite annoyed that this scene is over with so fast, because it would have been much more exciting at this point in the book for there to be an actual big, violent confrontation, to for this to be a, like, a physical reckoning. Like, no, the overpowering charge has to be overthrown. But if the rich people just started murdering little children, I feel like I would have rolled my eyes a little bit too much. It might have been a little bit too Squid Game-y, you know?
I very much get where you're coming from. And I do like that that's this scene where someone stands up and, like, we're not actually going to overthrow the system. Like, you know, it's been nice and we'll try and be better. We might even try and help out the poor kids a bit more going forward. I've certainly learned a lesson
exactly
here. But we're not actually going to stop a system. Just to expand on this while we're talking in the more, like, ideological plane about this book, I really enjoy the fact that we're talking about this fantasy school that was created, that exists in a pocket dimension that protects young wizards because they're basically, they get hunted by monsters. They're the most delicious things for monsters to eat. And the school has like a 1 in 4 survival rate, 1 in 7. But one thing they make very clear is that when they first created the school, like, the survival rate, the chaos that was before this system was worse. You know, it wasn't created to be a totalitarian system that put threats and dangers all to torment these young wizarding kids or to personally disadvantage the poor wizarding kids. It was better than the absolute chaos of before. It certainly it was an improvement.
People came up with a bad solution to a terrible situation.
Exactly. That doesn't mean that it's not right to keep pushing forward and to keep gaining progress. I mean, that was like the allegory, I don't know if allegory is quite right again, but that was the reading that I really enjoyed, and one that I really enjoyed reading, particularly, you know, in our modern world. Yes, it's great to see that things are better now than they were in a feudal system. Thumbs up. That doesn't mean we should assume that we've absolutely cracked it and this is the best system we possibly could have.
All right, to take a step outside the metaphor behind the book and actually talk about the content. All right, let's take an overall view of the book. Duncan, what happens in the book? What's it about?
The Last Graduate is about our main character, Elle, in her final year at the Scholomance School, and her relationship with Orion Lake. As they...
Okay, I disagree there.
Well,
I felt... not interrupt straight away. I feel like it's bizarrely understated, their relationship in this book. I really liked it in the first book. I was actually very excited to see where it went in the second one. And most importantly, the big cliffhanger of the first book is Elle receives a letter from her mum, the first communication she's had from her in 3 years, and she says, stay away from Orion Lake. And I'm like, whoa, this is going to really change things. It doesn't change anything. She immediately ignores the letter, and then nothing changes whatsoever. And their relationship goes at a molasses pace. They barely talk to each other for huge parts of this book.
True. There's like one cute picnic scene, and that's it. It's basically just implied that they've now fallen in love. And until they have their kind of... Basically, they put up these stone walls near the very start of the book, where they're like, we're not talking, we're not going to engage with each other, oh, it's too much of a risk properly falling in love with all the danger. And then we'll have this scene where they kind of break down and they admit that they love each other, and, you know, it's raining outside, so they run under the veranda. You know the scene, you've watched Bridgerton.
I have watched Bridgerton. That was not true when we read the first book.
You actually... Fair critique, it's not about that, and it did drive me up the wall that that cliffhanger is not properly resolved in any way. We don't know why she sent that letter. We can take like an implication, we can look into going, well, it could be because he's a dangerous person, he comes from a rich place, but I don't think we actually have enough information to know why her mother would have sent that letter then. But then in a world where there are people who can make prophecies at any time, who knows? Her mum could have had a vision.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. And because our main character really does just ignore it.
Yes. I disagree.
I don't even know the reason why they're stony.
I think it does matter. I think it matters a lot. But I want to get into that when we talk about, like, overall criticisms.
Okay.
I've interrupted you, Duncan. I apologize.
Back to the
Please
plot.
Continue with the synopsis.
The plot of this book is that our main character, Elle, at the very start of the book, she gets put in a room with a bunch of, like, young pupils, and she's like, what's going on? And we slowly get, the book goes on, she gets more protective and more interested in helping out other kids in the Scholomance. As it gets even further and towards her graduation, it becomes more abundantly clear, one, there are less monsters about than there really should be on any level, and two, the school itself is encouraging people, subtly and very, very not subtly, to be more cooperative. And this starts to really pick up when we get into their final term, where they've passed their exams. And instead of studying, they basically do these, like, gym-based gauntlets where the school throws everything it has at them so that they're more prepared to face the graduation. Graduation in this school is a death run through the graduation hall to the exit point, which traditionally is filled of all the horrible monsters that haven't managed to get into the school proper. And they just sit there, hungry, waiting for the kids to come out at graduation. And it's a total, I think it's a 50% death rate graduation event.
Exactly. It's this wanton slaughter. It's this epitome of a broken system which people just aren't ready to fix because the gears of a society are oiled with blood. Then, you know, this, we have to go through this ritual sacrifice in order to keep the system going. Blah, 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 blah. And as the book goes on, you know, we go through this this very changed Scholomance. So the thing which I think is the most defining difference between the first book and the second book is the first book was full of this overwhelming sense of danger. Going down the hall was dangerous. Going to lunch was dangerous. Forming personal alliances was very important because if you didn't have one, you were in constant danger. Orion's character was defined by him violating the this established law of the way people had to bargain for their lives. He's an egalitarian. He's a philanthropist. He has all this magical power, and he just wants to give it away to protect people. He wants to save them from monsters. Orion's interruption of the system of the economy of death in the first book propels everything that happens. You know, monster attacks are getting worse because Orion's killing monsters. Sorry, he saved so many lives. The monsters are getting hungrier. They're getting more desperate. That creates all this drama. But, and this is one of the big things that I was really interested to see how Naomi Novik would handle, the climax of the first book is they fix the system, which is supposed to purge the graduation hall. It's supposed to kill tons of the monsters. And I believe we probably talked about this in the episode, like, what's the next book going to be like if there aren't any monsters? Isn't that going to be not very exciting?
I mean, I'm really happy that Naomi Novik takes that question head on. So Geordie, was this book, just using that one word, as exciting as the first for you?
Definitely not as exciting. It has a lot of stuff in it that I like, but it's definitely not as exciting.
It certainly isn't moment to moment driven as the first book, where, as you said, Death Man's every corner, we're terrified for Elle's safety and the safety of a lot of the other characters. One of the main things that gets brought up is, wow, we now have a moment to stop, to breathe. We're not living hand to mouth, day to day anymore. So what do we do with our time? What now? We have a moment to actually think and assess. Which obviously brings a lot more kind of ideological conversations. But you're right, is just less threading. After the opening couple of chapters, we know that Elle, Orion, and pretty much all our core cast aren't looking to die before the climax. I pretty much was like, yeah, this is what we're doing now. No, there are no more sacrificial lambs to keep me on my toes. You're just going to wait.
Yeah, and the big theme around... the big theme, I think the thing that gets explored is because the school is so much less brutal, all it can do is it focuses all of its... It seemingly focuses all of its ire on Elle. It sends monsters after her and the kids she happens to have a homeroom with, these, like, 14-year-olds. It's really funny to me how, you know, in the previous book, the main characters are, like, the 16-year-olds. And because it's a YA book, you know, they're quite grown up. They have grown-up conversations. There's lots of teen drama, but, like, they're very mature and focused. But the 14-year-olds who they're looking after now are written like 11-year-olds. They're, like, timid and small and very shy and like, literally, like, diminutive. They're described as being, like, tiny creatures. And that was funny to me because, you know, they were so... the gap in their ages, as someone who works with teenagers, it's really small. Like, 14-year-olds and 16-year-olds, I really don't think there's that much of a big deal. And the funny thing about it is right at the end of the book, it's mentioned that, like, oh, look at all the changes that happened in Orion. Now that, you know, like, puberty's hit him at 17 years old, I'm like, he probably didn't actually grow, like, 8 inches this year. He probably was already, like, built up when he was 16 years old. You can't all be late bloomers.
I would throw two things back at that. Not that I necessarily disagree, but I would just say, I think one of the things it's meant to emphasize, the reason why I think Novik has done this, is to put focus on how being in the Scholomance matures them beyond their age. Being in that life and death situation, that's what's making them having to grow up fast. So I think that's why we're getting absolutely. That more intense playoff, why the 14-year-olds coming in are written to be younger to give the contrast. I recognize it. I accept what you're saying. I'm merely kind of saying, oh, I didn't mind that. I get why.
No, that's very fair, Duncan. The point is that in the previous book, Orion was this great idealist. He was this little... He was, as a lot of people have called him online, he's a golden retriever compared to Elle's black cat. He just wants to help everybody. Elle scorns him for this because it's impractical. And in this book, Elle is the one who takes on that role. She starts protecting the little people. She's been infected by his generosity and his kindness and his humanity. Suddenly, he's going around trying to hunt monsters selfishly. You know, he's not really doing it to protect people anymore. He just needs it to fuel his magical power.
Oh, this was a great element. Now, Geordie, can you tell me, did we know this in the previous book? Because this was new to me, but it was also, maybe I knew this?
I think we did know it, but I forgot it as well, Duncan, in the meantime. Everyone else expends magical power when they cast spells and has to earn it back by accumulating mana through boring labor. Orion is unique in that when he kills a Mal, a monster, he absorbs their magic. So he has he's like a source of infinite power because it takes less energy to kill a Mal than the energy he gets back from it. So he's like a walking violation of one of the laws of thermodynamics. Maybe number two.
Number two, well done.
Thank you. Yeah, he's infinite energy. If he kills Mals, he gets more power to help him kill more Mals. And he loves fighting Mals. I have to say, as much as I was irked by the fact that the Orion and Elle relationship was put on hold through so much of the book, where they are so distant from one another, and then right towards the end, they start to very quickly get magnetically drawn back together. I have to say, once they are back together, once they start being in a romantic relationship again, I really liked those sections, and I was really compelled by the, like, personal conversations and the revelations which Orion makes about himself. His explanation for why is he like he is? Why is he so weird?
I adored this as well. I really enjoyed particularly not only the fact that we get this insight into the character, the way that it's written, the way that the character of Orion Lake shares this information with Elle, the way he seems timid about it or a bit embarrassed, and he's sharing these kind of personal stories of when he grew up, which I can't even put my finger on it, but it just hit the feels for me. I was like, this seems, in this fantastical setting, this feels so real, about someone just sharing
yes.
who they are with another person that they care about. And the tone of, like, I hope she doesn't reject me for this, but I really want to be more mm-hmm. vulnerable around her, just struck mm-hmm. amazing. It was just perfectly done. Hammer on the nail.
I can put a word on it, because I said this out loud. I was sitting there on my hike, sat down, I was looking out over the countryside. I frowned as we were having this conversation, and then I opened my mouth and I went, oh, he's autistic. I was just this grand revelation of, like, oh yeah, his special interest is fighting monsters.
It's all he cared to do as a kid. His parents had to kind of, like, compromise with him, and he just wasn't interested in making friends. He just really wanted mm-hmm. to get into hunting mouse.
And a great bit about, like, how, like, I don't want the other things that everyone else wants. Like, I want things that other people think are strange. And part of the reason why I like you so much is that, Elle, you're a weirdo too, and you get me. And you're the only person who gets me.
It also puts such a light on his actions in the previous book. The way he just kind of doesn't care about what the social construct. I was like, oh, this aligns. Mm-hmm. I also really like how it kind of reframed for me his relationship with the other sort of privileged kids. Oh, what's the word? There's a particular word in this book for kids that come from, like, the high wizarding communities.
For conclaves.
Conclaves, yes. Wizarding conclaves.
No, the enclaves. Enclaves.
The conclave lives. It's that sense of, like,
enclaves.
They don't get him. But because he is so good in his special interests, because he's just, you know, effectively high-functioning in that way, he is then useful.
Yeah.
So he's allowed.
It is good. And the way they sort of blend, they again, you're fusing something you might see in a typical, just high school teen romance or drama book. Like, you have a character who is permitted into a social space only because they serve a function. You know, they're being exploited for the sake of companionship by the cool kids. Like, oh, they're only hanging out with you because you can score them liquor. Or they're hanging out with you because your house has a pool or whatever. And your value to them is not contingent on them liking you. It's only contingent on what you can provide to them. And Elle can recognize that this is wrong. And Orion can't, because that's just not the way his brain works.
So we're going to keep talking about Orion. Like, we've really praised his relationship with Elle. And he's not the focus. Elle is the focus. But I feel like I want to get through him.
He's not really in much of his book, to be honest.
He certainly disappears for a lot of the front. I also found it quite interesting, particularly that exploration of why he hunts the mouths, or the monsters in this world. Because in the first book, it is painted as purely altruistic. And it's not that he isn't altruistic, but I think it almost doesn't occur to him on quite the level that he's being altruistic. He likes it because he enjoys, one, doing the action, and he likes the fact that people praise him for it. This is the only way he's gotten, you know, accolades and people value in him, because he's good at doing this.
Yes, I think it's definitely close to that. I want to say that I don't think it's quite... he does it for the appreciation. Because I remember there's a bit in this book where he actually finds the appreciation, the accolades, kind of awkward. I think the more the thing is that, like, this is the one thing, not only that he's good at, it's the one thing he can do that he knows is good, it's right, it's correct. You know, like, in a way that a lot of autistic people like following the rules. This is the rule. You save other human beings. That's the right thing to do. And it's like, okay, well, I'll just do that then.
Oh, I relate so hard from the confusion in life. Mate, can you? I don't get it. You get taught at school very basic rules about treating other people who you want to be treated. Killing people is, by and large, considered wrong. And then as you grow up, you're basically then taught, don't be so naive to believe the fundamental rules we've literally just taught you. I'm like, guys, why have you given me this rule set if you've basically only to send me into a society that, let's be clear, doesn't seem to follow it? My own personal issues. But I like that. And I like Orion. And he remains that happy golden retriever in this story when he's there. I love his romance with Elle. This is nicely done. Going over to Elle, though, our main character, short for Galadriel, because her parents knew how to name a baby. I forgot that, by the way. Throughout the majority of this book, I completely forgot that, because she's just called Elle until, like, the last, second to last chapter, the last chapter. She gets called Galadriel again.
Yeah, it's only brought up in a book, like, two times. It's, I had forgotten a lot about her parents, actually, because I'd forgotten where her mum lived in Wales in the commune. I'd forgotten that her dad died in the Scholomance. I had forgotten that she was Indian. I had completely forgotten that.
I'll be honest with you. When her mum lived in Wales, I did have a... Because I remember that. And I don't know, maybe because she's called Galadriel, I was picturing like a young Cate Blanchett, and then I was thinking, wait, no, that's not right. Her dad comes from an Indian conclave. I need to adjust that in my head. I had a similar issue.
So focusing on Elle, her arc throughout the story is that she's compelled through having to look after these little kids to start caring more about, wider groups of people. The social net she's able to care about keeps growing, much to her chagrin. When the book starts, she has two friends and Orion, and that's it. That's everyone she has to care about. And then literally it's just one kid happens to bring her a message. She feels obliged to him. She has to save his life, and now she has to protect a whole classroom of kids. And then gradually this grows and grows. This sense of this need she has to protect people starts to become more concrete, and the circle starts to widen. We start to get this sense that outside, in the real wizarding world, there's conflict going on between the enclaves. There could even be a whole wizard war going on outside, and they don't know that. They don't know for sure. Things start to heat up within the Scholomance. Different factions from different nations start to square off against each other. And it's this that Elle has to fight against. It's not about monsters anymore. Now, all she has to do is end capitalism and fix the human condition.
And I'm so proud of her for trying. But, sorry, I say that as a joke about Elle, but I'm actually really delighted with Naomi Novik to even approach this subject matter in the way that she does and have that be kind of the wider conflict. Because it's such a more complex conflict to write about and to write a resolution for, because in our world, little tidbit here, Geordie, I don't think there is a found resolution to this.
We're working on it.
Day by day. What that means for the character of Elle, though, is that she is kind of fighting against those established rules of how the system used to work. And we get a lot of, particularly in the early part of this book, Elle kind of internal monologue being like, well, I shouldn't be this nice. Oh, I should just walk away. There's really detailed descriptions of like Elle thinking to herself, now I should have just ignored them and walked out the door and been quick about it and gone down the hallway. And then I was surprised at myself as I stood up and then flung my magic spells about. This plays out kind of a few times. I don't think that makes it sound like it got repetitive or boring, but it shows her constantly kind of fighting back and getting more confidence in this idea herself before we then get in the mid to late parts of the book, her then trying to take this attitude and new kind of perspective and communicate it out to other people. And that's one of the things that I think really gets interesting. There's a character called Chloe, who is, by all accounts, you can't see my hands going here, but air quotes, nice person. She's a nice person.
Yeah.
But she's not, or at least she's slightly behind Elle in these sort of revelations about how altruistic. So I really enjoy these conversations she has with Chloe, because Chloe is nice and is like, yes, absolutely, we should help people. But she's the first one that Elle then talks through. Yeah, but I mean, we've got to save lots of people. Yeah, but we've got to save all the people.
Chloe is nice, but not good. Like, Chloe's friendly, but she also is a member of the New York Enclave. She has everything provided for her. And there's this really interesting moment in it where she gives Elle access to the New York pool of magic. And Elle, because she's the only person fighting monsters, and she has very costly, powerful magic, she starts to, like, drain the New York system of power dry. And this forces the New York Enclave people to actually start generating mana, which they had never been doing before. This is almost more of a power fantasy than anything we've read in any of the books so far. Like, making the rich kids actually have to work for their capital. That must just have people salivating.
I mean, it did to me. This bit was just like, oh, the karma. Yes. Go on.
I felt it was a little too easy to actually get them to, like, contribute. I feel like that it could have been explored in some more interesting ways. Like, what if they were, like, you know, like, outsourcing their the efforts required to generate mana to, like, smaller people, and then had to be corrected on this and then forced into line to actually contribute, as opposed to just doing it. But hey-ho.
I think that's a legitimate thought, though. I think one of the only issues I had throughout the majority of the book, I know at the start of this episode we talked about that one character who near the end stands up and goes, oh, we're actually going to overthrow the system. By and large, a lot of the rich and powerful kids fall in line pretty darn quickly. And yeah. I know there's this slightly larger threat that's established, which is they're all kind of scared of Elle. At least that's how I interpret it. They're all like, she is powerful. If we don't, she might just be able to kill us. She probably wouldn't, but she probably could. And I don't know if it's how to read that. Like, yes, if you want the rich to start doing good, you really need to just threaten them with violence, and then they'll get on the right path.
If that's the case, then there should actually have been a threat of violence. Like, I will say one criticism I have of that scene right at the end, because the point of that scene is not to present that as, like, an actual moment of drama. Because if that was the case, it wouldn't be at the 90% mark, it would be at the 70% mark, and that would be the climax of the story. It would be about forcing everyone to get in line and do as they're told, to work for the greater good of everyone. Instead, what that's supposed to be is it's the rallying moment of seeing the naysayers put in their place. Everyone else comes together and they join in on the altruistic ideology. That's the satisfaction of the moment. It's just seeing that it works.
Sorry, Jordy.
Then you're supposed to just get a good feeling from that scene.
It's the scene in Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, where the one slivering kid jumps up and goes, there's Harry Potter, let's just turn him over. And they go, and everyone just stares at them. It's like, let's just escort that person off the
scene. Oh yeah, it is that scene. I had forgotten that scene existed.
Exactly. It's a kind, in terms of the emotional beat, it's a bit of the same scene.
Let's speak no more of Harry Potter. Now, fuck, what was I about to say? Right, yes. So, as you say, Duncan, it's a little too easy to get the rich to compromise on the system of power that's kept them at the top this whole time. And what's more, something else about this which I find interesting. The entire ethos of the book sort of gets radically changed when Elle is given a power sharer. So Chloe gives Elle a power sharer, which gives her access to this great resource of the New York supply of magic, which is a huge amount. It's a great reservoir of magical power. And this means that Elle no longer has to struggle in the same way she has before. It gives her far more time to focus on other stuff, like her studies, like hanging out with her friends. And there's a brief moment later where they sort of reckon with the fact that, like, I had sort of forgotten what it was like to not have this. So it's a sort of reflection of privilege at that point. But really, what this sort of did more than anything was, previously, Elle had access to all this extremely powerful magic, which she couldn't use because she would just collapse. She would run out of power. Now, she's able to go full bore all the time. Alongside the lack of monsters in the book, it again really detracted from the sense of personal drama. Elle is now pretty unchallenged in any remotely physical way.
I'd agree. It's made very clear, particularly when she teams up with Orion, that the two of them basically could carry the entire school, or could take almost the entire school at once. They are on another just power level compared to everyone else in their class.
And this becomes not merely subtext, it becomes text when they start to prepare for the graduation. Because the whole point up to this point is people have to form alliances. These small teams are how people navigate through graduation. They practice with their graduating teams, and then they get it down to a fine art. They go in, and then they try and make it through. And the idea that we're left with, we have all of these friends who Elle made during the first book. That's her alliance. Those are the people she's going to collaborate with. But as Elle's perspective changes...
And just to be clear, I just want to jump in there, sorry, Georgie. To be clear, when we're talking about these alliances, this is meant to kind of be mapped over to sort of friendship groups when you're in high school / senior school. You know, you've got your close friendship groups, maybe there's four, there's six of you. That's why you've come together. And it even shows, you know, with like the rich kids, there may be a core group of 6 to 8 rich kids, and then they have some hangers-on, and their alliance might swell to 12 or 16, but it's still those kind of more smaller groups, that sort of scale.
Exactly.
Yes, go on.
What eventually happens is that when they start to prepare for graduation, they have a special gym which magically gives them practice runs. And for some reason, these practice runs are way, way, way harder than they should be. Possibly even harder than graduation is going to be. And then there's a lot of time this book is spent speculating on two possibilities. One, the school is preparing for the fact that graduation this year is going to be so hard that they need to prepare in this way. Or two, the worst option, the school has registered that Elle is so powerful now that it has to present this overwhelming challenge that literally only she can beat in order to get through graduation. Which is bad, because that means that all of the groups, all of the alliances which do not have Elle in them, are screwed. They can't practice for graduation if the challenge is too hard, which means they will not be prepared for graduation and are going to get eaten.
It's a tight one. It's a bit of a catch-22.
The solution that Elle comes up with is she starts taking larger groups into graduation. If they need practice, then I'll just get more people to practice. Instead of a group of 4 people going in with me, I'll go in with a group of 10. Okay, I'll go in with two groups of 10. I'll go in with a group of 10 first, come out, and I'll go in with another group of 10. All right, how about we do a group of 50? And it's pretty obvious at this point where the book is going, but it still takes a long time to get there. That is a genuine negative critique of the book that I have. It's very obvious quite early what it's about, you know, what the end result is going to be, but it still takes a while to get there.
Well, I think it's true that it's very clear that this book is about Elle stepping up and actually looking after everyone in the school. There were a few twists along the way that I genuinely did not see coming. And I really want to talk to you about the big one now. And then there's another subject matter, I think it's a bit icky, but I do want to talk it through with you. Maybe you can help balance the books on it with me and foreshadowing for that one. But yeah, the big twist is coming in with about the 2/3 point. Elle's doing these runs. She's practicing with larger and larger groups of people. And then she gets a vibe from the school. The school is sending her messages. She suddenly sees it, kind of says to her, you know, come down, fire the service hatch that you took at the end of the last book and see the graduation hall. See what I'm preparing you for. So Elle goes, she makes the journey, and she sees the graduation hall as it was. And it's empty. There are no monsters. It's all been for nothing. It doesn't matter. Alliances, the training. This year, everyone can just walk out the gate and everyone's going to graduate. I didn't see this coming. I was like, I thought they were building to a big challenge. I thought they were building to like something truly horrific. And when this dropped, I was like, it was that moment of like, she's in this vast empty hall. And I just felt the silence.
Yes, it's a very impactful moment. I was surprised too. I was really surprised by the fact that Naomi Novik followed through. Like, the end of the previous book, the point is, you know, surely they fixed the machine. They solved the problem, right? Where's the drama in the next book going to be? Sure enough, there are no monsters around in the second book. Is that because they're all saving their strength for graduation? Is that why graduation is going to be so challenging? The fact that there are no monsters is really shocking. It's a very impactful moment. It is followed up by two subsequent feelings. The first of which is very negative, because you think to yourself, well, this has been a huge waste of time, right? We spent all this time reading chapter upon chapter about how they're preparing for this big confrontation at the end. There isn't going to be a confrontation. You just wasted all my time. But that is slowly weathered away, because the challenge becomes way, way more interesting. This year, everyone gets to graduate. For the first year in the whole of the 100 years of Scholarman's history, everybody lives. But there are not all the monsters are dead. The monsters are trickling back through. They're not in great enough numbers to pose the regular graduation threat. And one of those types of monsters are these tiny little bugs. And what these bugs do is they eat metal. And the machines which produce fire to scorch all of the monsters and clear them out, they eat the machine. And there's this serious conundrum, like proper catch-22 of the machine is designed to destroy monsters. But it doesn't destroy these things because they're too small fry. But you can't reprogram a machine to attack these monsters, because then the machine would destroy itself. So you have a seemingly insurmountable problem. Elle can take the easy path. She can walk out the doors. She literally had the option in that exact moment to open the doors and leave right then. But if she does so, she's abandoning all of the kids coming up behind her.
So what's she going to do, Geordie? What's she going to do?
At first, the solution seems super obvious. So obvious that, again, I'm like, why have you wasted my time? Obviously, the solution is they bring all of the kids out and they blow up the school. And you're thinking like, yeah, obviously that's what this book is going to be about. But actually, a good amount of time goes into explaining why this is not necessarily viable. They have these big Star Trek-style conferences where all of the students, the seniors, get together and they say, okay, let's come up with solutions for the problem. And they shoot through tons and tons of ideas, and they shoot them all down one by one. Such to the point where you go, actually, you're right. I didn't really think this through. There are a lot of factors that need to be considered. Like, you can't just blow up the school. It's really dangerous for kids out there.
It goes back to why the school was built. And they all get this horrible reminder that no matter how terrible it is inside the Scholarmonths, the reason it was built, the reason why people still permit it to exist, is because it's better than nothing. It's better than what it was before. So are we just going to go back in time to the previous kind of anarchy? Or do we accept the, not much lesser, but still measurably lesser evil?
And the solution they come up with is actually legitimately really good, really exciting, and justifies all of the stuff we've been doing up to this point. Not all of it, to be honest. Like, you spend a lot of time learning about a lot of the wizard kids' magical powers and talents, and really, ultimately, the entire school is going to be saved by four students. Five students.
That is true. It is quite an interesting thing where a book where it's all about caring for more and more people, in many respects, that does end up in you just shrinking the size of your core cast. Because as a reader, while altruistically you can obviously believe, yes, I want all the kids in this school to live, you don't have the page count to give them all names and personality. And obviously that's the point. You don't know everyone. Doesn't mean you shouldn't care and want them to live. But it means that then we get to spend less time actually developing some of our core characters. So when you get to the end, there are still only kind of five people that, again, air quotes going again, matter. Because they're the ones actually implementing the grand plan to get everyone out. Now that grand plan...
I will say that a casualty of this is Elle's alliance. You know, like, I feel like her relationship to her close friends suffers a lot when she takes on this bigger burden. She expands her social network to the entire school. They matter a lot less. I felt like all of the conversations they had subsequently were way less important. They didn't feel as intimate. They didn't feel as special or personal. They felt like big conversations about a big situation, not conversations between school friends.
It kind of felt like, and I don't even feel like, because there's a bit of me that thought, well, maybe Orion's going to kind of step into this ground in terms of talking things through with Elle. But I don't think that actually necessarily happens. I think what was missing here is maybe a moment where Elle needed just that emotional support in a way that, like, Orion is clearly unsuitable to give.
Yeah.
And then she could have had a moment still with this character where they just have a close conversation of, like, how are you feeling, Elle? You're trying to overturn capitalism and save thousands of lives. How's the pressure doing?
Yeah.
And we didn't have that. And I actually feel like we could have really benefited from just a bit more Elle needing to go, oh, well, actually, it's been really hard.
So personally, I have to contradict you there and say that scene did happen. Her friend Adia has that conversation with her when she's at her lowest moment. She says, oh, my sister died, and she didn't die in the Scholar Man, she just died in an accident, and that can happen to any of us, blah, blah, blah. And
it's not the same conversation, though, I don't think.
And it's just not that emotionally
still
impactful.
Talking about, because
it's a bit rote. That's all. I think that's the reason why you don't really think that one counts. Like, it happens, that scene does happen, she does receive that scene of emotional support. It's just not an amazing scene, it just feels a bit rote.
That scene in particular, because it has this kind of, I don't know, clever little bit where Elle's sort of pushing back and going, let me guess, you're going to tell me this. And she goes, no, actually, my backstory is this. And you go, okay.
Yeah, exactly. And I have backstory C, not A or B.
And also, I found that scene was more about giving Elle this eureka moment where she kind of goes, oh, I think it leads her to her grand, a bit more of the how she's going to deal with the problem, which... To be clear, so what they actually come up with is they're going to effectively lay out a honey trap. They're going to set the sort of scent for all these magical kids in the school. And when it comes to graduation, they're going to open the floodgates and let all the monsters of the world flood the school. And then once all the kids are out, they're going to slam the doors, tilt it up, and fling it off into the void.
Yeah, exactly. So the idea is that they turn the school from being a prison which the kids are sent to keep them safe, becomes a prison for the monsters. There's a joke in there, like someone says, why can't we send the monsters to school? And that's what they do. They're going to trap them in the building and take away the door. And legitimately... I think it's such a clever resolution because the honey trap is set up way earlier in the book and they try to make it work and it fails and then you forget about it and then it comes back and you're like, oh, right, that was really good setup. And if there's something which these books do well, it's wizard logistics. These books are great for magical logistics. Some of the most fun we had in the first book was just learning about the wizard curriculum, about how the the magical school just summons books for you to read that contain information tailored to you, that it, like, it marks your work and no one knows how it does it. And the way people have to solve problems using the rules of magic in clever ways. I like that a lot. I like that a lot. And the solution they come up with here, it's all about cleverly using all of the things we've learned up to this point, all of these little spells.
And it also gets all of the characters, or all the people in the school, sorry, to work together. There's this sort of magic setup where they're going to have effectively a loudspeaker system guiding the monsters on through the school. And this needs to be kind of manually manufactured. So lots of the kids have to come together and work towards this project. That's what we discussed earlier, when that one character goes, I know we've been working on this plan for months, but that was just to keep us busy. That's why they're having to pull their time together to set out this grand trap.
Yeah.
Does it work?
It does work. It actually works a little too well.
I had the same thought. I thought that, you know, this is going to be a classic case of they do it, and then someone does something, or one kid, you know, just they're a little bit selfish, and it nearly makes everything fall apart, and then Elle would have to be there firefighting and be like, go, and oh no, because of that one thing, now those people have died over there, but we're nearly out. And that does happen a tiny bit, but ultimately this is a very clean cut trip.
Yeah, because the moment you're talking about, Duncan, it happens. And what it's all about, it's classic conundrum. It's the Spider-Man situation. We've got to say... Sorry, it's not a Spider-Man situation. It's a fucking trolley problem. I was thinking of Spider-Man 1. I watched it again recently. It's a trolley problem.
No, you can talk about Spider-Man. It's Mary Jane or the cable car to children. Don't you worry.
One of the kids leaves, he walks through the portal home, and he gets dragged back through by a Moormouth, literally the worst kind of monster that there exists in this book. Elle managed to destroy one in the previous book by jumping into its mouth and exploding it from the inside, because that's pretty much the only way to destroy them. She is one of two human beings to ever defeat a Moormouth. She becomes the first person in history to defeat two, because despite the fact that jumping into the Moormouth's mouth is the worst thing that ever happened to her, and it can have a serious, like, a traumatic event for her, she does it again. Obviously, this is supposed to be this moment of triumphing over her own fear, but the focus of this scene should not be her triumphing over her own fear to do something traumatic again to save someone's life. That's not what this scene should be about. This scene should be about her being unable to lose even a single life, endangering the entire plan. But it doesn't endanger the entire plan. They quickly adapt the plan around her, she saves this one kid, and there are no consequences.
It's just too clean. And it sounds weird to be disappointed. Oh, I'm just so disappointed that everybody lived. But I just... am a little bit. We set up such a violent and scary world that although I'm very happy for our main character Elle, that in this instance everybody lives, I almost feel like maybe there was a learning point or some potential, and who knows, maybe it's explored in the sequel, where Elle might have to come to terms with the idea that not everybody always lives, that maybe you can do all the right things, but you can't always save everyone. I don't want to be criticising that it's not necessarily exactly where I wanted it to go, but it certainly, I think, robbed the climax of a bit of impact because everything just went basically to plan. By and large, the detour was so tiny.
Exactly. Because, Duncan, the problem is not that Elle gets her way, but pretty much everyone lives. We'll get to that last part. It's not that. It's that that problem is solved so neatly. It should be... well, I say should. It would be more dramatic if Elle steps outside of a plan to save one kid and endangers everyone else. So something needs to happen to resolve that problem. Like perhaps previously selfish kids who only stood up for themselves are inspired by Elle's heroism, and they step up and they have to save the kid. Or she steps out, she saves this kid, she opens up a breach in the defenses, and then the previously selfish kids step in and they seal it up. But instead, the person who seals up the defenses is just a nice guy from England. Like, he was never a bad guy, he was always very friendly.
It's really hard when you're thinking how you would have enjoyed it more. And I think that's really, we are just saying, for our taste, we would have enjoyed this climax more if something a little bit more tied into the wider themes could have played out during the action. Because that's what you always want. You want.
But also.
Yes, but also.
But also, the action just isn't that exciting at the end. Like, it's nice to see the plan come together. Again, the wizard logistics is good. But I got no sense of peril whatsoever from the final scene. Orion is fighting like an army of monsters, and he doesn't face any challenge whatsoever. Because, and that's sort of the point. The point is that he is so powerful when he fights Mauls. He's been suffering all year because it weren't enough. Now he has thousands of them, and he can slaughter them wholesale. The problem is, there's a kid, the English kid, I think his name is Michael. He teaches L to make a spell, which is an impenetrable barrier, which nothing can get through. So when they get down to the end and it's just her and Orion left, everyone else is left. Everyone else is gone. They have an impenetrable barrier. They're in no danger.
You sound so disappointed.
I am disappointed because you want to have the exciting action scene at the end be an exciting action scene where people are in danger. But unfortunately, someone decided that the book should have an impenetrable barrier spell when it didn't need to have an impenetrable barrier spell. Make the barrier penetrable.
Have some time sensitivity. They could have hanged there. They could have waved at them. At all the monsters. Yeah. And this leads us up to the...
There is drama in the last scene.
The final scene.
We've oversold the idea that there is no excitement. There is drama.
There is, and it's a good one to be talked about. So in this final moment, Elle is casting her Get Lost into the Void spell on the school. And Orion's there, and the monsters are closing in, but they can't get to them. And all they've got to do is at the last moment, just before the spell takes effect, step through the magic doorway. But Orion just doesn't do it. What does Orion do, Geordie?
There's this super Moormouth. This Moormouth which, it was set up in a previous book. There are two ancient Moormouths, 100 years old. They've been eating children for all that time. Patience and Fortitude, that's their names. And all they do is wait by the doors to the end of the year, and then they eat students as they run by. This year, there was no sign of them. They were gone completely. Patience returns. She is eaten Fortitude, and now she is bigger and badder than ever. She's the worst monster that has ever lived, probably. And if they try to explode the school and they leave, there's a possibility that she could get out. She could get out into the world and cause havoc. Now, that means that one of them, Orion decides that he's going to stay behind to hold her off so she can't get through the gate. Now, obviously what should happen is, again, the impenetrable barrier spell. It was set up earlier that the impenetrable barrier spell can just be turned into a bubble, which you can put people in and just move them. So they could just take her and just throw her like a baseball. But they don't do that.
Nope. No, they do not. They forgot that skill. It's like when the Jedi forget they have Force healing. It just happens occasionally. Yeah. God forgive them. It's a high-pressure situation.
Orion, copying the same power move which Elle's dad did right before she was born, says, I love you, kisses Elle, and shoves her through the portal. And then the book ends. Again, another cliffhanger. I wish I had seen it coming. I allowed myself to be surprised again. I went, oh my god, you did it again! There's another goddamn cliffhanger!
I know, this was one... I'll be honest with you, I saw this one coming. So this was one a mile away. Obviously.
I saw him staying a mile away. I did not think it was going to be shoved through, boom, book is over.
Oh no, I felt that. I felt it would be. What I was surprised at was whether or not it would be a I'm deciding to stay or a self-sacrificial, like the barrier fails, the Maws are coming in, and Orion just goes, pushes her at the last second. This did surprise me a little, though, that it was a, I'm in heaven. Bye.
What do you mean, I'm in heaven?
Like, he could have gone. I interpreted this as him deciding to say to kill all the Maws.
It's, I don't know, man. It's just, I feel like it's something that could be examined in the next book. Like, what's the reason behind this? It's just so overwhelming. It just feels a bit stupid. Like, it's just so obviously the wrong decision to stay behind in the school alone forever to fight monsters. I get that obviously it ties into that, like, this is only a thing I really enjoy doing. It's the only thing I'm interested in. But he was excited about the life outside that El was promising and making the Golden Enclaves, a thing which we have not brought up once, even though it's the title of the next book.
Because it's not important to this book. And it sort of drove me a bit mad, because I felt like Orion had done character growth to be beyond just wanting to kill Maws. And I also felt like we'd established that there were some type of Maws that probably still existed in the world that, like, don't move or couldn't come to the school. Like, he still had so much purpose. Absolutely. Oh. Annoyed me.
It feels, I was not as engaged by this cliffhanger ending as I was by the first one. The first one, I had all sorts of questions. Why is she supposed to stay away from Orion Lake? What's going on in the outside world? What does her mum know that she doesn't? How is this going to change their relationship? I felt like this is my main critique for the book. The cliffhanger from the first book is not even remotely resolved in this one. I finished writing a book, Duncan. I was really happy with it, and it had two parallel stories. And when I got to the end of the book, these parallel stories, they never linked up. You know, a lot like, say, in Game of Thrones, you have, like, parallel running storylines. They don't link up, but they will eventually. I got to the end of that book, realized these stories don't link up, and they are going to link up in a huge way in book two. But there's no way I can just come to an audience and just show them, hey, I've got these two independent stories that have nothing to do with each other, seemingly. I bet you want to see how they link up. People would never accept that. I felt so unable to get past this hurdle that I just put away the book. And I put away, and I never sent it to any agents or anything, because I was like, no, it's just, it doesn't work as a story. And unfortunately, when that also meant that two perfectly good stories were, like, thrown away, because now if they don't link up, they're kind of pointless. The fact that I got to the end of this book, and I have no idea what's going on outside the Conclaves, and I have no idea why she's supposed to stay from Orion Lake, it's kind of unexcusable.
And this is a really interesting point to kind of, I think, be leaving off on. Because I love some of the ideas in this book. I love the core messaging in this book.
Yeah.
I didn't like the ending of this book.
I like the prelude to the ending. I like the lead up, the immediate lead up, but I don't like the climax, and I don't like the twist ending, and I don't like the lack of resolution.
It's sort of funny that I kind of say that I enjoyed this book just as much as the previous book, and I think one of the things I've discovered through this conversation, and I'm not rolling back on that statement, but I enjoy it for very, very, very different reasons. I remember when we did the first book, I almost kind of let the kind of capitalist allegory fly over my head. Whereas this book, it was what I was most engaged in and most kind of looking at through that lens.
Agreed.
So, what would I say? I'm still interested in the sequel, but I'm not as interested as I was when I finished Deadly Education. In fact, if this is the end...
Absolutely the same. And considering it took us 2 years to read this one, I think we're probably going to get Winds of Winter before we end up reading The Golden Enclaves.
Well, okay, well, that is some mighty strong words. Winds of Winter 2032. Come on, guys. Listen, my bet.
That is what someone has mathematically calculated. I watched a YouTube video on it. Duncan, I never actually gave my overall opinion on this book. And I did like it. I give it positive reviews. If you liked Deadly Education, definitely read this one, and I definitely recommend Deadly Education, so there you go. However, I did not like it as much as the first one. Like, not even close. Of course, I liked the first one a lot, so that goes to show, you know, still a good book, enjoyable enough. But I would, if it weren't for the twist ending, I would not be rushing out to give the next one. And I feel like that was kind of quite deliberate. Really leave us in the lurch. Strange the Dreamer style. Wow. You have to read the next one.
See, Geordie, I almost feel the exact opposite. I think if we hadn't had a twist ending, and I didn't feel a little bit played, I'd be more likely to want to go and see how we explore the ramifications of this in the next one. I think that's something this book was missed, is maybe it could have had a little bit more, like, throughout, kind of foreshadowing of, right, this is the plan for overturning the school. What are we going to do next? The only real foreshadowing that we get for, like, wider events is this kind of, is there a wizarding war, is there not, going on in the outside world? And I am curious of that. In fact, that's something we haven't talked about, is the one of the main issues that comes up. We talk about sort of poor kids, rich kids. There's a lot more in this book to talk about different nationalities of kids. There's a lot more that's focus true. On the, well, you've got the Western Sphere kids from like London, Manchester, New York, and you've got the Eastern Sphere. And to be honest, because they speak different languages, they go to different classes, it's actually quite segregated. So
yeah,
this is true. One of the main boundaries that Elle has to overcome is how does she bring these people together, quite a lot of them not taught speaking common languages.
Unfortunately, the solution to that is demonstrate your overwhelming power and ability to destroy them, and that works somehow. That's how you get people to like you, is you demonstrate how effortlessly you could destroy them, and then they live in peace, as we learned from the nuclear age.
Very important. I think one of the reasons we haven't actually had a wider conversation about that is because I don't think it's nearly as well addressed or written that I can't dive into it as much. In fact, there were certain points where I was worried that we were kind of going to go down a bit of a, I don't know, stereotyping route, particularly when Elle was first struggling to deal with the sort of Chinese-based enclaves and the kind of power struggle there. I was like, oh no, what are we doing? How's this going to play out? Everything stayed on the right side of the line for me as a reader. But there was certainly a bit where I was like, oh, Naomi, what are we doing? Please walk this line carefully. I ultimately think she did, but I did have a little scare.
Now, Duncan, I decided I would read the blurb for Golden Enclaves, the last book in the trilogy. You know what? Maybe Winds of Winter isn't going to come out. I don't think we need to read this book.
Wow, this feels like a real down ending to the episode for a book that I liked. I recommend
it. Maybe it's good. Maybe I'll read it. But I'm just going to read the last part. So yada, yada, yada. Elle is out of the Scholomance. She's in the world. The world is in peace and harmony. Peace and harmony are developed all across the enclaves of the world. Just kidding. Instead, someone else has picked up the project of destroying enclaves in Elle's stead, and everyone she saved is at risk again, with a full-scale enclave war on the horizon. So yeah, that's what's set up in this book. That's exciting. And so, the first thing Elle needs to do after miraculously escaping the Scholomance is turn straight around and find a way back in.
That annoys me, and I was really worried they were going to do that. Have you ever seen...
That's...
the Netflix Sabrina the Teenage Witch kind of reboot, The Wicked Adventures.
I have not, I'm afraid.
No, right, I'm just going to say, because this happened in that show, and it annoyed me then. There's a scene in that show, sorry, bit of a YA crazy time that show is. First season I quite liked, but at the end of the thing, it's the second season, they like seal Satan inside, this guy sacrifices himself to seal Satan inside his body, and then like he is sealed, locked up in hell, so that Satan can't take over the world. And at the end of the episode, Sabrina's like, right, we're going to go down to hell and get him back. I'm like, he literally just sacrificed himself. He literally just sacrificed himself to save the world. And your number one ticket is, let's undo his heroic sacrifice and put the world back at risk so we have another season.
Yeah, that sucks. And the thing that I'm most excited about is like, wow, you've developed all these characters in this really specific environment. What's it going to be like when they're out in the world and they can go back to their social safety nets? They're back in their families, their enclaves, their personal groups. What's it going to be like when Elle wants to go on adventures, but her mom wants to keep her safe? That's going to be really interesting. It's going to be them being more grown up. Oh no, she has to go back to school? Well, that's a real downer. That's a serious downer. I think I probably will look into the next book. Maybe I'll look up like other people's reviews of it. That's a weird thing to say, but because I rarely actually do that. But I think I will. It's really put a damper on my interest.
Wow, I mean, it's not the direction I thought we'd go. Can I ask though, if you're listening to this and you're like, you have read Golden Enclave and you're like, guys, don't worry about it. It does deliver. It has all the ideas you want. Please do let us know. Like, I am desperate this time to hear other people's thoughts and opinions on the Golden Enclave, on The Last Scratch, on the Scholomance in general. Please reach out and let us know. The best place, as always, is our Instagram, It's Just Fantasy Podcast. Also, our Gmail is fantasypodcast@gmail.com and on Blue Sky at Just Fantasy. Geordie, would you recommend this book, though? Just The Last Graduate. Would you recommend people who have already taken our recommendation to read Deadly Education, do they read Last Graduate?
Yes, they should. It's a good follow-up for the most part. It takes the ideas forward. It's nice to revisit the characters. There are aspects of it that aren't great, but the resolution of the Orion L love story is strong. Orion's character, when he is in the book, is taken to interesting places. That one scene of dialogue with him is like just really good, like legitimately really good. And I approve. It's a good book. It's a good book.
And I completely agree. I recommend Deadly Education because it's amazing. I recommend Last Graduate because it is a very good follow-up that maybe has strengths in very different areas. But overall, I would say I liked almost equally as much, but in a very different way. Shame I don't feel compelled to continue the series.
Yes.
Do you know what, Geordie? There are many series out there that I have enjoyed books in, but not finished. Wheel of Time being the first that comes to mind.
Yeah. Now, Duncan, we know for sure you're not going to pick the Golden Enclaves, and we won't be picking it until The Winds of Winter come out. That's been established. That's what we'll do. I mean, I think that's a good rule for the podcast. What then instead are we going to be reading?
Oh, Geordie, I've been umming and I've been ahhing and I've been thinking, and I just got to this point where I went, do you know what? I need to share this with Geordie. Like, properly. Like, I spent a lot of time with this book and in this universe. So I think Geordie needs to experience with me. And I think it'd be very different than anything else we've ever covered here on the podcast. Really striking off into the past. Maybe one of the oldest texts we've ever covered. No, we did do that Bram Stoker one. Maybe the second oldest text we've ever covered.
I can see where this is going.
Geordie, I think we should do Princess of Mars.
Right. The first John Carter story by Edgar Rice Burroughs. So this is from, you told me last time, this is 1912, right?
That is an excellent question. Let's say, no, Duncan, let's just find out. No, not the movie. Yes. That's right, Georgie. 1912.
We are going to find out if this is the greatest disaster since the Titanic sank the same year.
Ooh. I hope not. I've already read it. It certainly is a book of its time. This is one for maybe a bit more historical appreciation. At least that's what I feel. I don't know. Geordie, read it yourself. Come, tell me your thoughts. It's certainly going to be, I think, a conversation starter. Guarantee you that.
I mean, I know what John Carter's previous profession is, so we're going to have to talk about that.
Oh dear, we're going to have to talk about that.
But we'll have to do that next time. I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol.
So long, everyone.
Bye.